Welcome to Preaching Podcast. This is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary. And when I say we, I mean myself, Deirdre Good, Josh Davis, and normally Althea Spencer Miller, but she is not able to be with us today, and we look forward to her joining us at some point in the future, probably next week. And we're going to look, as usual, at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare preachers, teachers, proclaimers, pundits for Sunday worship. So what we're looking at today are the readings from Pentecost 17, the 17th Sunday after Pentecost, the Sunday closest to September 21st, Proper 20, Year B in the Revised Common Lectionary, and we get tracts 1 and 2. But it really is interesting to see how tracts 1 and 2 overlap in the focus on wisdom material. So, for example, tract 1 has, as the reading from Hebrew Scriptures, Proverbs 31, which is all about, I'll just take the opening lines, a capable wife who can find. But track two has as its reading from, or for, or somewhat connected to the Hebrew Scripture, but not directly, because it's from the intertestamental material, the Wisdom of Solomon, which we were looking at last week in terms of its connection to wisdom material. It's the Greek text given, attributed to King Solomon, who of course can't possibly be the author, but it's the Solomonic corpus of material. And he's the putative author of all the wisdom literature, the Proverbs of Solomon, as we saw from the book of Proverbs, and it continues in the readings of track one. But the Wisdom of Solomon in Greek continues a different instantiation of Solomon as a sage whose wisdom reaches into and is articulated by Hellenistic Greek in the whole of the book of the Wisdom of Solomon. So that's the focus of some of the readings from Hebrew Scripture this week. If I can jump into them with a bit more specificity, the collect encourages or petitions that we not be anxious about earthly things, but instead love things heavenly. And even now, while we are placed amongst things that are passing away, to hold fast to those that will endure. So, of course, holding to wisdom in the face of folly is something that our age, even our week, even our day in the United States is very much trying to do. I'm not going to go into that in more detail here, but let me focus on track one, the reading of Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31 is a really interesting text. It's been used in various ways. I'm going to, in a moment, turn to that. But we've got a lot of Proverbs 31, except we start at verse 10. So there's material before verse 10, which sets the setting, gives us the setting for this. And we stop at verse 31, which is the ending. And the opening lines orient the reader towards the fact that this is a text describing a capable wife, even if more honored in the breach than the observance. That is to say, it's hard to find a capable wife. If you were to look at traditional, or shall we say, more evangelical, more conservative forms of Christianity, maybe in this country, I'm just looking at a website that asks, what is a Proverbs 31 woman? Well, what is a Proverbs 31 woman all about in this website is about being a good wife and a good mother. So she is trustworthy because the heart of her husband trusts in her and he will have no lack of gain, which of course means that the Proverbs 31 woman is married and of course runs a household. That would be the assumption here. The Proverbs 31 woman, number two, is a blessing to her husband and not just a helpmeet, increases the influence of her husband, helps him, doesn't compete with him. Proverbs 31, number three, is an eager worker. She works with willing hands. Proverbs 31, 13, she does what needs to be done with a heart for her family instead of complaining. The Proverbs 31 woman, number four, is resourceful. She, verse 14, is like the ships of the merchant and brings in food from afar, knows how to manage finances that are given to her by her husband. She's motivated. Number five, she rises while it's yet night, and so on. Okay, so you get the general idea of all of this. And this, of course, takes quite seriously what it means to be a Proverbs 31 woman. But if you apply some critical thinking to the description of the woman in Proverbs 31, and if you were to know something about biblical scholarship, even simple biblical scholarship, not complicated, obscure and difficult to find biblical scholarship, but simple biblical scholarship, you would find that Proverbs 31 is not simply a description of a good wife, capable wife, but rather an acrostic poem. So what it does is it takes every letter of the Hebrew alphabet and in the course of chapter 31, spin out the qualities of the woman in the description by means of attributes that begin, for example, with the Hebrew letter Aleph, which is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and so on. So you can then realize, as I'm hoping I'm explaining, that this is not so much a description of an ideal woman or even any woman, but rather an exercise in literary imagination and productivity. So in English, we would say, you know, a good woman is A, B, and then you would have descriptions of her in A and B and then C and D. And these would be attributes or qualities. So this means that it is not really helpful to set up a kind of impossible reality in the use of Proverbs 31 as if it were a description of an ideal wife. Some people have suggested that since this occurs at the end of the book of Proverbs, that it might even be a description of woman wisdom. And of course, woman wisdom we have discussed in previous weeks, but we also see woman wisdom in the wisdom of Solomon, which is in Prac 2. It's not just in the passage that is selected for us from chapters 1 and 2, fragments of sections, chapters 1 and 2 in the Wisdom of Solomon, but it's there in the background because we looked at Wisdom of Solomon 7, which describes wisdom as imperishable, light, a force that passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. But in this section of the Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 1, what we see are the ways in which wisdom and goodness go together as the assumption behind the passage, and foolishness and ungodliness, opening section of our part of the Wisdom of Solomon, actually oppose the good and wise individual. And what we've got in this passage, Wisdom of Solomon 1:16 to 2:1 and 12 to 22, is a collective evil group of people saying about the righteous individual, short and sorrowful is our life, and there is no remedy when a life comes to an end. No one has been known to return from Hades. What are we going to do? Let's lie in wait for the righteous individual, the one who is wise, the one who is favored of God, because he is inconvenient to us and opposes our actions, reproaches us for sins against the law, accuses us of sins against our training. So instead of, I don't know, going off and doing something evil by themselves without harming other people, this group, as the Wisdom of Solomon describes them, the group of the wicked opposes the righteous individual. And they're going to test his words to see if they're true. I'm just continuing to read the passage. And in fact, what they're going to do is kill the righteous individual. Because if the righteous individual is God's child, God will help him and will deliver him from the hand of his adversaries. So let's find out what he does with insult and torture. And let's find out how gentle he is. Let's make a trial of his forbearance. Let us condemn him to a shameful death, for according to what he says, he will be protected. Now, of course, the story doesn't end there, but it's really a horrible and really quite striking description of the single individual who doesn't seem to have an army protecting, except for God, of course. God is on the righteous individual side, and the wicked are in profusion and plurality and are going to kill him. We know what's going to happen. If you read the Wisdom of Solomon 3, you know that the righteous are in the hands of God, and God is going to protect them, and God will give them life beyond death. So I'll just spoil the story and tell you what's happening there. So it's the fate of righteous and wise individuals versus the foolish and wicked plurality of people. That's just one of the important themes of wisdom literature. So I've discussed Proverbs 31. I now need to go to Psalm 1. Psalm 1. Okay, Psalm 1 is the beginning of the entire book of Psalms. So it's not simply the first psalm. It's rather a way to introduce the whole of the book of Psalms. And as we know from the translation we're using, as opposed to describing an individual, which is what the Hebrew and the Greek does, the NRSV has pluralized this. Happy are those, happy are they who have not walked in the counsel of the wicked, nor lingered in the way of sinners, nor sat in the seats of the scornful. In the Hebrew and in the Greek, we find an individual. Happy is the one who has not walked in the counsel of the wicked. I just want to point out in regard to this opening verse that as it describes how the righteous individual, the happy individual, seeking to further knowledge of God by study of Torah, study of the law, which results in further righteousness, the goal of further righteousness, we have three different verbs describing wrongdoing: walking by the advice of the faithless, standing instead of standing in the path of moral failures, or sitting in the seats of the mockers. What the righteous individual does is be a tree planted by streams of water bearing fruit in due season, meditating, verse 2, on the law of the Lord, the Torah, and meditating on God's law day and night. So it's a great description of the way in which an individual reading the entire book of Psalms as instruction in the law, as descriptions of human condition in ancient Israel, Psalm 1 orients us not just to itself, but to the whole of the book of Psalms. Okay, I'm not going to talk much about Jeremiah or Psalm 54. We can go to it. James 3, we can go to it in our discussion. James 3 continues the reading of the book of James from last week. And I just want to emphasize one line from it, as I will mention one line from the gospel in a moment. Show by your good life, this is sentence number 2 in the passage of scripture we've got selected from James 3. Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness born of wisdom. You know, I'm very interested in the quiet virtues like meekness and gentleness and self-control. And we see them in this period of Hellenistic literature, not just within the New Testament, but outside the New Testament. We can discuss that if you want. But in regard to the gospel, what I want to stress is the repetition of the teaching about the need to help the disciples understand that it's just the case that the Son of Man, the child of humanity, is to be betrayed into human hands, in a way replicating the language of Wisdom of Solomon, the beginning of Wisdom of Solomon. And these hands will kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise again. And of course, the disciples don't understand this. Mark 8, 9, and 10, the central section, they don't understand each time Jesus teaches this. And the first time we looked at last week, Peter rebukes Jesus for saying these things. But I want to concentrate on one aspect. It's got to do with the human hands into which the Son of Man is betrayed in the opening two sentences of Mark 9, 30. I'm just going to contrast this with the way in which Jesus uses his own hands in the course of teaching. Whoever, he says to the assembled 12, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. And to demonstrate this, he takes a little child, puts the child, we don't know the gender, puts the child among them and taking it in his arms. It's not just that the child is an object of attention, it's that Jesus embraces the child. And the verb here for embracing is only used this one time in Mark's gospel, and it's translated quite well, taking it in his arms. That is a grasp, a gentle touch, a holding, an embrace, you know, just a love and care and respect for this little child who somehow embodies being last, being inferior, being the one on whom, the one who is dependent upon the well-being of all adults. And he says, Jesus says to the disciples, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. So here's the child as the exemplar for the teaching, not for the aggression of human hands, but for the care of human hands as accompanying teaching about the death of the Son of Man. Okay, Josh, are you still there?
I am, yes. Well, I just wanted to remark, and we can discuss this, or it can just be an observation. The way in which these readings tie, I see a theme tying these readings together around this issue of wisdom and the way the wicked rise up against the righteous and the path of the righteous leading to life and this line, the ungodly by their words indeed summon death, from the wisdom of Solomon, is really interesting, I think. And that seems to run through this. Every once in a while, the lectionary sort of things kind of click in a certain kind of way. And it seems like these readings do that rather well. Because at least from the perspective that I've had for a while, I've read, I've been really attuned for a while to the way in which, say, this kind of deuteronomic, you know, choose life or choose death runs through the New Testament. It's not necessarily the whole of things. I mean, there's obviously wisdom elements there. There's other theological strands of the Hebrew Bible that are at work there. But it seems like that it's a big part of what's going on in Paul's writings, that he's working against in a certain kind of way. So I think it's interesting because you can even see that element reflected in James. You know, you've got these conflicts and disputes among you. Where do they come from? They come from this element that's at work in you, which is leading toward death as opposed to toward righteousness. So flee from the devil that's going to pull you away in that direction and those kinds of things. And so I think a lot of what Paul is doing is a response to some of that stuff, some of that theological perspective, right? Like, where does it come from? Does it come from following Torah, or does it come from the Spirit of God? That kind of thing. And so, those are just some elements that are jumping out to me. And I know I'm being very cursory in my connecting of them, but I was really surprised. I've never really, this element of the suffering, the innocent suffering servant, righteous servant of God is very significant in the major prophets. But this element from the Wisdom of Solomon just looks like it basically is, you could just read that right alongside Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. And there you go.
Yes.
And go
ahead. Like, no. Thanks for highlighting that. It looks like it's an interpretation of 2nd Isaiah with regard to those suffering servant passages that you've already mentioned helpfully and alluded to. But it's a Greek reflection. It's in the context of different vocabulary, different worldview, different language, because a lot of the words of Wisdom of Solomon are unique. They are invented words. They're words that haven't existed before Wisdom of Solomon comes into being. There have been studies of the vocabulary of Wisdom of Solomon. So it's as if they're not just, you know, repetitions of reworking Second Isaiah material with regard to the righteous individual who is going to suffer and be killed, but it's as if they are kind of updated for the reality of the whatever the Wisdom of Solomon presupposes, maybe the treatment of right and of righteous individuals in the context of maybe, I'm hypothesizing, imagining first century before the Common Era Alexandria. Yeah. And Josh, what happens as I'm sure you're well aware, is that the righteous individual who is killed by the wicked group of unjust people is saved and redeemed and even resurrected by God in Wisdom of Solomon chapter 3, which and is then called child of God, because this is what the language is inferring. This individual is God's child, and therefore God will help him. And this then feeds directly into the crucifixion accounts, because in the crucifixion accounts, there are mockers and people who deride Jesus as he is suffering and dying on the cross. And they say, why don't you call upon God? God, if you are indeed the Son of God, God will surely rescue you. Because that's the meaning of your baptism, in which you were designated Son of God. That's the meaning of the temptations. And so, do you see? So these deriders, these mockers, these passers-by, as Jesus is dying, are picking up the language of 2 Isaiah and Wisdom of Solomon and what's going to happen to Jesus. So the Wisdom of Solomon is a really key link between, because I don't really see 2 Isaiah all over the Gospels, but right. I do see the filter of the Wisdom of Solomon in the shaping of the designation of Son of God. If you say you're the Son of God, well, come down from the cross.
Yeah.
That language in Greek is right there in the Wisdom of Solomon. So it's an updated version.
Well, that was going to be my question was, it's really surprising to me that given the fact that, you know, this was in the Septuagint, they would refer to this as scripture, or at least it was available as such, that why it wasn't appealed to more directly. And that is the answer to the question. It is, but it's oblique. There's implicit quotations of it. Because, I mean, it's really quite remarkable, like we are considered by him something base, and he avoids our ways as unclean, right? This sort of flipping of the script there in terms of like, you know, he's declaring things clean that they declare unclean, but we are considered by him. I'm looking at this through the lens of, you know, Jesus, right? So he calls the last end of the righteous happy and boasts that God is his father. Let us see if his words are true, and let us test what will happen at the end of his life. Right. And it's remarkable because, and this was you and I, before we began recording, we were discussing something that very much circulates around these ideas, but it's the idea that, like, okay, well, we're going to see, it's as if they're acting on behalf of life, but really what they're doing is enacting death. Things appear one way. But it's like they're saying, like, well, let's see if he really is righteous, and we'll pursue that through the means of death, right? And so this is the way in which the ungodly, in their words, indeed summon death.
Yes, they don't even just let him die. You know, they don't let him run a course of life or even a short life, which it would be in the ancient world. What they do is kill him. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, an active boundary-breaking conduct towards another human being. I mean, they think that there is no future to life after death, because in chapter 2 they say, short and sorrowful is our life. There's no remedy when life comes to an end. No one has been known to return from Hades. I'm reading the scripture that isn't included in our reading too.
Yeah.
The breath in our nostrils is smoke. The reason will expire, the body will turn to ashes, the spirit will dissolve like empty air. So it's a worldview, Josh. Mm-hmm. It's a worldview that is completely antithetical to the righteous individual who is looked after by God and called God's child. I mean, and then it turns out in chapter 3 that there are more righteous individuals. The souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them. So at a time when notions of afterlife are kind of creeping around, you know, the wicked have no sense of afterlife, so that everything they do is death dealing, which is what you were saying.
Yeah, and what is remarkable about this as well is the way in which there's it happens, or the things that they do. This is particularly the case in the instance of the life of Jesus. It's not, well, it does, God is mentioned in the words of the ungodly here in the Wisdom of Solomon. But in the case of the Gospels, there's a very explicit correlation between religious devotion of a certain kind and this kind of activity, the summoning of death, right? There's a way in which, as it's described here in the Wisdom of Solomon, there's something about a life that is lived, a righteous life. There's something about a righteous life that reveals a certain kind of religious devotion as being devotion to death. And I think this is really, really interesting, because they become aware of the fact. This is, again, through the Wisdom of Solomon. The speakers here, of the ungodly, they are aware of the fact that there is an indictment of them by the way in which the righteous person lives. And that's something that they're recoiling against.
Yes, it's as if they're drawn to it, but repelled by it. And yeah. Reject it and seek to destroy it because here we get verses that are just not included. What we get in our choice is chapter 1, verses 12 to 22. If we read verse 22, which is right at the ending, thus they reasoned, but they were led astray, for their wickedness blinded them, and they did not know the secret purposes of God. Yeah. In other words, the wickedness is the thing that it's not just bad in itself. It actually leads to the destruction of a bigger worldview. Not just that, the destruction of a way of looking at life that makes life bigger and better and more generous. Mm-hmm. And it contains within itself the seeds of redemption. Verse 23, which isn't included. For God created us for incorruption and made us in the image of his own eternity. But through the devil's envy, death entered the world, and those who belong to his company experience it. Yeah. So the bits that we need is not part of our reading, but it shows the antithetical perspectives of good versus evil.
Yeah, and the ways in which this way of being drawn to it and yet repelled. I mean, this is what I think Jesus is saying when he's calling them hypocrites, right? When he calls people hypocrites, it's not like you say one thing and do another. It's not just that. It's that there's something fundamentally askew in your whole approach to things. Like you're drawn to me, but you want to destroy me. That's instead of embracing what it is that the life that I'm present, the more abundant life that I'm presenting before you, you seek to destroy it, and that contradiction is your own destruction, right? It's very strange. But this element of this like pursuit of following Torah is the path of life. And not, it's a very, very interesting, it's a really helpful lens to look at what's happening in Jesus's life, to look at that through that. And you can see this and this is what I meant. You can see this in James. Like James very clearly sort of looks at the life of Christian discipleship through that lens. And I think it's very helpful. And I think it's at work in Paul too, but he's wanting to say in response, be very careful that you don't wind up like in the burdens that you put on these Gentiles, that you don't wind up in the position of the ungodly, right, in this situation. I think that's kind of the pivot and probably the first real significant debate that happens within early Christianity between, you know, those that are sent from James as Paul talks about in Galatians and what's happening there and the working out the implications of this. Like, yes, it is about life and death, but let's really think through what it means to include the Gentiles in this and rather we ourselves become by default death dealing in the kinds of burdens that we place on others. Or do we wind up actually denying Jesus and what Jesus has accomplished for us by by what we demand.
Yes, exactly. What do you make, how do you react to that little paragraph at the end of the gospel selection when Jesus, in the midst of talking to disciples, Jesus, who is not a father, is not a biological father in everything we know about Jesus in the first century, nevertheless, suddenly into this group of debating men, male disciples, probably, perhaps a few women, but not prominently visible, and Jesus, who is not a biological father, then into the middle of this comes, because he invites or brings this child in, here comes this little child, sort of unconnected somehow. It's like a tiny epiphany.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well,
you're a dad.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like the way in which this is an experience. I mean, I don't want to say I have this experience all the time, but I do have this experience of Danielle, my wife, and I. Like, there's so much of our lives is spent either doing work or the things that we spend our time doing for, in ministry or in teaching or whatever, and then taking care of or these children, right? And then so we don't get a lot of time just to have adult conversation. And every once in a while we do, and a lot of times it's about the interpretation of the Bible because of the nature of our work. And so sometimes we get into these conversations, and then like a child will come in and say, "Can I have more screen time or something?" And it can be annoying because it's like I only get one of these conversations maybe once a week and for half an hour. So I think all of that to say, what I imagine this as being is like an interruption, right? I think children at my age, at the age that my children are now, it's a little bit different. I imagine this is like a toddler that doesn't have a sense of where you should and should not go. Just wanders drawn to something, a debate happening about how to interpret the law or scripture, and a child wandering into the middle of that and being like, "We don't have time for this. You're in the way, get out of it." But the child is just there, drawn to it. No sense of propriety with regard to it. And his response is to not dismiss the child to be about adult business, but to embrace the child, to draw the child in and respond to this interruption as a gift. It is an interruption, but the interruption itself can be, there's all kinds of possibilities that inviting a child with no sense of propriety into a debate can introduce that wouldn't otherwise have been there. And being open to that's what I think of. That's my point of reference for it. And it's really hard to do because, I mean, sometimes you just don't want to have to deal with the things, and a toddler too, right? There's all kinds of things that could be involved in that, feeding them, changing them. They fell down. They're going to redirect things to what you take to be meaningless or not as important of what you're doing. And that's not to say that adults shouldn't have conversations or anything like that. It's just to say that it's like he's saying, to what purpose and to what end are you having this debate, right? And can you receive this? Are you capable in this debate of receiving this new thing or this interruption, this thing that could introduce or scramble the categories, but that has the potential of scrambling these categories?
Yep, absolutely.
Those are my thoughts.
I think that's really helpful. And of course, you're a dad, as I said, and so you have a different perspective on it. If there was someone who didn't have children or for whom children were not an essential part of their ongoing life, then it would have different repercussions. But it's just so striking that Jesus not only places the child amongst them,
yeah,
but takes it in his arms.
Right.
That embrace. It seems to me it sort of connects with James. Peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits. Of course, I can say this, Josh, because, I don't have little children wandering around distracting me from having really meaningful conversations that are only half an hour per week.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's what a lot of people thought. I'm sure that's what these people thought too at this moment. They're like, yeah, way to go, Jesus, you single dude that just wanders around fixing things and preaching.
Exactly. We have a whole family life at home, which you don't seem to have.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. But at the same time, it's even in that way, it represents what is familiar to you, so that you could receive it again for what it is, and not necessarily as an interruption, right? That he becomes a vehicle, his actions become a means by which to recognize the gift of something that you may have become, even just momentarily, callous to or jaded about, right? It is wonderful that you come here and ask me to give you food, right? I'm happy to do that, right?
Yes, exactly. And it's something that isn't death dealing.
Yeah.
It's something that is the interruption that is called for, is something that is the affirmation of life and life giving. I mean, ancient understandings of children are not ours.
Right.
You know, children are often expendable, and not just in the ancient world, but you know, in different parts of even our lives today too, and certainly in the 19th century, you know, with plenty of examples of child laborers and so on. So we might view these lines through modern eyes, but they are an absolute affirmation of a child that represents some different interruption that is no biological connection to any of the people who are assembled there.
Absolutely. I don't know exactly how to unpack this. I wanted to think about it through the lens of, think about a response to the child that was not just an ignoring of the child, but mm-hmm. one which deployed this reasoning of summoning death. that wasn't just which used the child as a tool in an argument, I suppose, right? Yeah. In the way that was. That at the same time did not actually notice the child, didn't receive the child in the way that Jesus is talking about here, but instead uses the child again, still as an object, as a tool for argument, as that kind of thing. Exactly. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's still death dealing, right?
But we're not. We're opening up avenues of interpretation. We're not trying to preclude, or compel. It's just an invitation to consider what we do with hands. We're going to use them to destroy other people, or we're going to use them to be gentle and welcoming.
Right, and that's where the point that, man, scripture is so complex and thinking through it, you really have to inhabit its world. But that's just an aside. But that's the significance, I think, about what Paul introduces into this conversation, especially with regard to the Gentiles, is that there is a way. I mean, you can imagine someone taking Jesus's words here and using them in a way that makes them into death-dealing tools in the same sort of way that James is saying, you know, look, you know, if you don't, you know, you have to bridle your tongue, and you have to, mm-hmm. you know, and the implications being, right, you need to be circumcised, you know, you should follow Torah. Mm-hmm. And Paul saying, yeah. Remember what he said, though, about like those things becoming death dealing, right? Like, it's a really, that ultimately what is significant here isn't, it's the spirit, right? It's following and living by the spirit and its fruit. Mm-hmm. And you can judge those actions by the fruit of the spirit.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, I hope that's not too far afield.
No, not at all. I think we could end there quite happily.
Yeah, I think so.
Good. I want to thank you so much, Josh. And I hope you get more than one half an hour for a midnight chat with Danielle about Holy Scripture.
Yeah, hopefully it won't be at midnight, but but yes.
Good. We'll send you that good wish. Thank
Doesn't
you.
Doesn't it sound riveting?
I'm afraid I can understand it completely, and that I'm privileged enough to do it pretty much whenever we would like. We have breakfast conversations and dinner conversations, and so this you have to look forward to. Assuming everything goes well. The children are launched.
Right. How much I enjoy this and how life-giving it is one of the reasons why doing this podcast is so significant.
Well, and we couldn't do it without your perspective. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Well, thank you. I will see you all next week.
Look forward to next week. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.